The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the tone was mostly cordial, except when the topic was President Bush. We'll score last night's Democratic debate.
Also keeping score, conservatives who say President Bush has created a bigger federal government than Bill Clinton ever did.
And recalling the now nearly forgotten worst disaster in New York City before 9/11.
There are no actual photographs of the fire. But everybody sort of saw the same thing, mostly from the Manhattan side, seeing the port side of the vessel completely up in flames, people pouring over the sides, and the first signs of rescuers making their way out to see what they could do.
These stories and a strange, horrific crime in Pennsylvania coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Russia has become the latest member of the UN Security Council to reject the new U.S. draft resolution on Iraq. Russia's foreign minister says the document is moving closer to the Russian demand that the UN play a central role in Iraq, but he said it's not there yet. He also said Russia is not opposed to having a U.S. commander lead an international contingent as long as the force has a UN mandate. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld continues assessing the military situation in Iraq today. The BBC's Valerie Jones has more from Baghdad.
Donald Rumsfeld headed north today to Tikrit, the hometown of the ousted President Saddam Hussein, to meet the American troops of the 4th Infantry. He was then said to be heading to Mosul, to another American base. He's come to Iraq to find out for himself the situation here. Mr. Rumsfeld is taking an upbeat attitude towards the state of Iraq. He's been talking of progress being made, of the situation getting better every day. But on the ground here, there's a sense of a deterioration in security. Today, gunmen opened fire at a Sunni mosque in Baghdad, raising fears again of the emergence of sectarian violence between religious groups.
The BBC's Valerie Jones. Bermuda's bracing for what could be one of the most severe hurricanes to strike it in decades. Meteorologist Eric Blake of the National Weather Service says Hurricane Fabian is heading straight for the island.
Fabian is about 110 miles south-southwest of Bermuda. It's still a Category 3 hurricane with maximum winds near 120 miles per hour. We expect the center of Fabian to pass very close to Bermuda in the next 12 hours.
Tropical storm force winds are already beginning to batter Bermuda. Forecasters say Fabian will bring 5 to 10 inches of rain and a coastal storm surge of 6 to 10 feet above normal tide levels. The Labor Department says the jobless rate for August dropped a tenth of a percent to 6.1%. But economist Hugh Johnson with First Albany Corporation says a separate survey by the government shows the number of jobs continues to decline.
The bad news is, and it's very bad news, is that we saw the seventh successive decline in the number of jobs in the U.S. economy, a decline of 93,000. Most of us had been expecting, forecasting that we'd see an increase, maybe 25 to 40,000. So this was a very disappointing employment report and really confirms that we still have a recovery in the economy, but it's a jobless recovery.
Johnson says the economy has lost more than 400,000 jobs since the beginning of the year. Stocks are mixed at this hour. The Dow is down 36 points. The Nasdaq is up about 10. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Marathon Oil is eliminating 265 jobs and closing its production office in Denver. The Houston-based company says most of the cuts will be at company headquarters and at U.S. production business units. Marathon says the cuts and consolidation are part of an effort to trim costs and to focus on its core business. Following the cuts, Marathon will employ nearly 2,700 workers. The European Commission says it's ready to fine Europe's largest economies if they keep breaking budget deficit limits. Right now, the Commission is focusing on France. Doug Bakshin has more from Luxembourg City.
Germany and France broke the European Union's deficit limit of 3% last year and expect to do so again this year. According to EU rules, the nations should risk fines if they violate the limit for the third consecutive year in 2004. Both countries are facing tough budget fights as they try to cut deficits while a slow economy lowers tax revenues. Tax cut plans in France increase the risk that Paris will break the EU rules for a third year. EU Trade Commissioner Pascal Lamy told French RTL Radio, in his words, "We shall be reminding France of its obligations, and then the question is whether we throw the book at it." For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Luxembourg City.
Taking a closer look at stocks, the Dow Industrials are down 36 points to 95.51. Trading has been active, 618 million shares. The Nasdaq is up 10 to 18.79, and the S&P is up a fraction. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Eight of the nine Democrats running for president met in their first major televised debate last night. Not in the room, but present on everyone's mind, the Republican incumbent. There were no knockout blows, but all the candidates, including Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt, won roars of approval for attacking President Bush on his Iraq policy.
This president is a miserable failure. He is a miserable failure.
Confounding the pundits, the candidates refrained largely from attacking their own. Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman voiced one of the few attacks on frontrunner, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, criticizing Dean over trade policy. But all candidates agreed on the need to improve the economy and U.S. infrastructure. Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
Rebuild our cities, our streets, our water systems, our sewer systems, new energy systems. It's time to rebuild America. We have the resources to do it. We have to have the will to do it.
Well, we have invited our regular Friday editor roundtable to move up to the front of the class to discuss politics and potholes. Joining us, Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hello, Guy.
Hi, Robin.
Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hello, Robin.
Well, Randy, start with you. Did you learn anything last night?
Not really, Robin. We all know the Democrats don't like President Bush, and whether it was planned or not, the fact that they were criticizing him really redounds to their advantage and softens up the president, I guess, for next year's real rounds of elections. It was pretty obvious that they each had a message to get across, and they probably succeeded.
But there was that one universal message, and Guy, were you surprised by that? Because going in, everyone assumed they'd attack Dean.
Well, I thought a couple of them did, actually. I think they were a little sensitive to not look as if they were piling on, but certainly Lieberman tried twice. You know, what I was struck by was the fact that there was so little new that came out of this. These guys were just recycling parts of old speeches. I've seen these sound bites before, and there wasn't much said. And I don't know whether the audience noticed it, but even when they were asked a question on subject A, they somehow managed to move it around to subject B because they happened to have a good zinger there.
Well, that wouldn't be all that unusual. I mean, you know, politicians try to stay on message, and it seems as if today's labor news underlined their focus on jobs and the economy. New Labor Department stats came out showing job cuts heavy again in manufacturing, August being the seventh consecutive month of cuts in payrolls. This week, Bush announced the appointment of a job czar in the Commerce Department, and he gave an interview yesterday, one of his very infrequent sit-downs, with CNBC's Ron Insana, practically begging businesses to hire. So this would seem to be the only thing we're going to hear about.
Well, they're still talking, though, Robin, about the troops being there in Baghdad. They're still talking about the $60 billion more it's going to cost, and they're talking about the tax cuts. It is the Democrats. So I think there's a connection, but they first have to resolve how they pay for a lot of these new jobs programs.
Yeah, and Guy, how did Howard Dean come out in that respect? He's been criticized in the past for not really having a firm foreign policy, either platform or delivery of that platform?
Well, I thought he was a little stiff last night, but I do think his foreign policy is as coherent as anybody else on the stage last night. He didn't really loosen up as he has been on the stump around New England and New Hampshire. He looked as if he was not really on his game.
There was talk, in fact, that maybe he's actually acting like a front-runner guy.
Well,
and it was Dick Gephardt who was getting red in the face, or John Kerry, who was seen as too stiff, was cracking the jokes.
I thought Gephardt actually showed more passion last night than he's shown in the last 12 years on any subject, and if he keeps it up, he might gain some support somewhere.
Joe Lieberman, the only candidate who said the U.S. should send more U.S. troops to Iraq.
Yeah, Lieberman is positioning himself as the candidate that you would want to vote for if you like George Bush, but I'm not quite sure that that's going to play very well in the Democratic primary.
Hmm. Well, moving on to some of the other candidates, just anecdotally, Carol Moseley Braun impressed a lot of people that we've heard speaking. She seemed to hit on some issues that, you know, were missing from the men. Let's listen.
I am also very concerned about the pay gap, what I call the sticky floor, on which many women, who are sole providers often for their families, are stuck. Women right now, you've heard 76 cents on the dollar. That's for Anglo women. African American women, it's about 67 cents on the dollar. And Hispanic women, it's about 56 cents on the dollar. You can't use 56 cents to buy a dollar loaf of bread.
Randy, it was refreshing to hear something other than Iraq and manufacturing jobs cut.
True, and she was very thoughtful about the single-payer health care plan that she had, too.
I thought she was extraordinarily prepared last night. Her demeanor is very gracious and friendly, and I thought she did very well.
Mm. We should say Al Sharpton was the only candidate who wasn't there, which is a shame because he usually can be counted on to make some really pointed quips. He was delayed by bad weather. But you both pointed out that John Kerry seemed to be trying to take on his aloof image. Let's listen to him.
In fact, I think the only jobs created in the United States of America by George Bush are the nine of us running for president of the United States.
Guy?
Well, you know, John Kerry is a fellow from Massachusetts, and we people up here in New England aren't too good on the
warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, we're not good at warm and fuzzy. We're not too good on telling jokes, wisecracks. It's difficult. But he's facing a real challenge from Dean, and he knows it, and he's thrashing around trying to find a way to deal with it.
Randy, we mentioned that Joe Lieberman did directly attack Howard Dean a couple of occasions. That seemed to be, you know, the sharpest exchange when there was an exchange about Dean's stand on trade and jobs.
He had called that, I think, the Dean Depression if somehow Dean would loosen up or tighten up the standards for NAFTA. I was impressed that, in fact, the other candidates decided there would be no gain for them, I guess, to take on Dean right now, but to try to focus on their own message. And actually, Lieberman, I think, may have hurt himself, only in the sense that his attack didn't seem to have much weight to it.
That's right. These guys are looking for something that Dean says or does. In this case, it was the difference between international labor standards and American labor standards. It wasn't enough to merit that jab.
Randy, how did the concerted, you know, attack on President Bush play in your area? His polls, President Bush's, are slipping slightly, but might this backfire on the Democratic field to so gang up or be perceived as ganging up on the president?
The two policy items that the president is strongly supported on here, having the troops still in Iraq and the tax cuts, were all opposed by the Democrats. And I don't think that's going to play well out in the Mountain West. Those have been very strongly supported here.
Mm. Overall, going into this debate, polls showed that very few people could name any of the Democratic candidates. Did last night's debate change that, Guy?
I doubt if anybody saw last night's debate except you and me and Randy, so I would doubt it.
We played it on our front page, Robin, so we're trying to give a little more exposure, and I think the fact that some of the candidates are now coming here to Arizona next month for the next presidential debate will certainly help.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire.
the Our Way or the Highway approach to foreign policy, which many observers see as the essence of Bush administration dealings with other countries, now seems to be giving way to a new openness to other points of view. This week saw startling shifts in administration policy on both Iraq and North Korea. To discuss the administration's seeming new respect for realpolitik, we're joined now by Steve Weissman, chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve, thanks for joining us. The Bush administration says its approach to foreign policies evolved to meet changing realities. Nothing special about that, right, at this point in an administration?
There probably ought to be nothing special about that because life changes and reality evolves. Mm-hmm. But as you said earlier, this administration has had a very fixed view about the world, and that view has included marginalization of organizations like the United Nations, which this administration did not want to have more than a cosmetic role in Iraq after the war was over.
Now, what about North Korea? We've spoken about Iraq. President Bush has said he loathes Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader. And we've said, the United States has said all along, we'd do nothing until North Korea did what we demanded, dismantling nuclear facilities. Now we're talking about a step-by-step process with incentives. What about that change?
That's a very interesting change, and it's also evolving. This administration is torn ideologically over North Korea, like probably more deeply than any other issue, even Iraq. So if the United States is going to work cooperatively with its partners in the region to negotiate, it was inevitable that it was going to have to adopt more of their point of view in those negotiations, which is to offer incentives to North Korea to change its policy. In other words, carrots as well as sticks.
Yeah. Well, there are dangers, though, are there not, Steve, to changing the policy at this point? The Our Way or the Highway approach, if you will, does have a simplicity to it, a directness, a kind of clarity. Can't openness to too many points of view in a complicated world lead to the kind of diplomatic chaos?
Yes, that's the fear. And that, in fact, that's been a bit of the experience in other cases. The biggest example was in the Balkans, in Bosnia and Kosovo, where it was very difficult for the United States to carry out military actions because they had to get approval from other countries, from NATO, from the UN, even to go after bad guys, for instance, in Bosnia back in the 1990s.
How does it affect how other countries approach the Bush administration when our bark isn't followed up ultimately by all that much bite?
Well, this administration has got a very precarious relationship right now with its closest allies. Not long ago, Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, made a joke before a group where he said the rest of the countries in the world regard Colin Powell as like a separate country that occasionally does business with the United States because he's not entirely in charge of American foreign policy.
Yeah, you quote an unnamed diplomat in your piece in the New York Times today saying, the question is whether the world is ready to pick the U.S. up off the floor and dust them off. A lot of people aren't ready yet. When might people be ready?
I think they'll be ready when the United States is ready to make more concessions than it's willing to make about who's going to run post-war Iraq. Hmm. The Europeans they view Iraq as perhaps not a failure, but not yet a success. And they are now being asked to cough up tens of billions of dollars to keep the country going just for next year alone. They want more of a say in how that money is spent.
Which must be excruciating for some, particularly civilians in the Pentagon.
It is excruciating, and they are still in denial on it.
Hmm. A foreign policy still very much evolving. Stephen Weissman, thanks very much for speaking with us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Weissman is chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times. Just ahead, the worst disaster in New York City prior to 9/11.
Coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The idea that what happened in New York City on the 11th of September 2001 could ever be forgotten seems inconceivable. But 99 years ago this summer, another catastrophe in New York City also seemed so profound, so terrible, that it seemed impossible anyone would ever forget it. But now, nearly everyone has. On June 15, 1904, 1,000 New Yorkers died when the steamboat General Slocum went down in flames. The finger-pointing began soon after, a tangle of recriminations and the question, how could this have happened? A question also not entirely unreminiscent of the aftermath of 9/11 that we're still living. Well, joining me in the studio now is Edward T. O'Donnell, who's reviving the memory of the tragedy of the General Slocum as author of the new book, Ship Ablaze. Mr. O'Donnell, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Tell us about the General Slocum and who was on it that June day in 1904.
Well, it was like any other June day. It was a beautiful day, in fact. People on board that boat felt quite blessed by the fact that this annual excursion, they were members of a church, taking what was then the 17th annual sort of end of the Sunday school year picnic. And for these people, these are working class people, most of them children of German immigrants. This is a rare day to get away from it all. Mm-hmm. And midweek, no less, so that, in fact, anybody on board that boat was either taking time off from school or household chores, or the numbers of men that went taking a day off from work. So quite a rare opportunity to really get out and enjoy themselves.
The biggest concern before the General Slocum left the East 3rd Street Pier was whether it would rain or not. But what happened and how soon after it left the East 3rd Street Pier?
The fire might have actually been underway even as they were loading the boat, and it was a very slow-burning, smoldering fire in a forward compartment that actually had a lot of hay on the ground.
Something called the lamp room under the main deck.
Right. Most boats have what's called the lamp room, which means the everything room. Lamps, oils, rags, tools, equipment. And in this case, it was a room that had no windows. So to look around, you went in, struck a match, saw what you needed, took it, blew out the match, threw it on the ground. And the night before, they had actually unpacked a lot of glasses from a barrel. And to pack glasses in those days, you used hay to keep them from breaking. So there was hay all over the ground, and somewhere in that room, a spark found a home and smoldered away quietly for some time. So it was about 10 minutes into the journey up the East River before a deckhand was notified that there was a smoke coming up a stairwell.
He did the worst thing he possibly could have, this deckhand. He left the door open, feeding the fire with oxygen.
That's right. He approached the door. He had only been hired 17 days earlier, had never done a fire drill, and he saw smoke pouring out from underneath the door. And most people know today that you don't yank open a door under that circumstance, but he did, pulled it open, and there were four vents from the outside that fed oxygen into that room. And there was, with the door open, tremendous rush, took that smoldering fire and pushed it on to the next phase, which is a free-burning phase. And he was unable to do anything to put out the fire at that point. And eyewitnesses all said the same thing. The boat went up in 3 minutes. The boat went up in 5 minutes.
A monumental fire that many watched from Manhattan and the other boroughs. They could see it as it was happening.
That's right. There are no actual photographs of the fire, but everybody sort of saw the same thing, mostly from the Manhattan side, seeing the port side of the vessel completely up in flames, people pouring over the sides, and the first signs of rescuers making their way out to see what they could do.
Now, there were lifeboats on this General Slocum. There were life preservers. The boat had been inspected not so long before. Why did so many die?
Well, the boat had 2,500 life preservers as required by law. It had 6 lifeboats as required by law. But the life preservers had been purchased for the first season back in 1891, and 13 years of sun and salt had done them in. And inspections, which in those days were pretty much a sham, passed over them year after year. And the General Slocum had actually been inspected 5 weeks before the fire and given a clean bill of health to run full for the rest of the 1904 season.
There were just payoffs, and that's what the inspection amounted to.
No doubt. So we never were able to, no evidence proving a payoff, but certainly that seemed to be the way things worked. The federal inspector was a rookie inspector, and he actually had no training in boat safety, boat design, and his formal training with the inspection service had been to follow other ill-trained inspectors around for 3 or 4 weeks.
1,000 people died, and now a tragedy almost completely forgotten. How did you hear about it?
Well, I went to New York to begin graduate school at Columbia University, and so being immersed in New York and then New York City history, I was able to learn a lot about the city. My fields of expertise are urban and ethnic history, and this was a very urban, ethnic story about this German enclave. And like for most people, it's a real stunner when you hear about the tragedy itself and then the fact that it's been forgotten. So when I first learned about it just a few years after moving to New York, it stuck in my mind. And then I used to give lots of guided tours to fund my graduate school education, and I would go through that neighborhood and pass by the church on East 6th Street, which is still there.
St. Mark's.
Now it's a synagogue, good New York City fashion.
St. Mark's then, yeah.
Yep, St. Mark's, and tell the story, and to an equally to astonishment at anybody who listened. So when it came time a few years ago when I decided I'd like to try my hand at one of these, I guess I call them dramatic nonfiction stories like Perfect Storm, this one seemed like the logical choice because it had all the elements and the fact that no one had really remembered it.
Given, just to finish up, how utterly forgotten the General Slocum is there any analogy to 9/11? Is it conceivable to you that 100 years hence we will have forgotten what happened at the World Trade Center?
Well, it's sort of depends on how you define forgotten. I think 9/11 will probably, like Pearl Harbor, always be there in the history books, in the memory, certainly of people who lived through it and lost people that they knew. But events like this eventually are forgotten, at least on one level, when all the people who participate in them finally literally die off. And in the case of the General Slocum, there's one woman left. She's 99 and a half years old. She was a six-month-old baby on board the vessel. I had the privilege to interview her and look through a scrapbook that her father had made. And that's really what's left of the General Slocum memory. We can remember it and commemorate it annually as it is each year in New York. But these things tend to slip more into what I call historical memory, where they're memories of factual events. And you can, in some cases, tap into the emotions of it, but you never really can pass that raw experience on from one generation to the next.
Edward T. O'Donnell, thank you very much for joining us on this.
My pleasure.
Edward T. O'Donnell is author of the book Ship Ablaze, The Tragedy of the Steamboat General Slocum.
Next week on Here and Now, Congress holds hearings on intelligence lapses leading up to September 11th, 2001.
And filmmaker Rick Burns' heart-wrenching finale to his series on New York on the second anniversary of 9/11.
That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Bill Clinton declared the era of big government is over, but conservatives disagree.
As much as I hate to say this, the Bush administration is guilty as charged in this regard. The federal government is expanding dramatically. The era of big government is back.
Also, a bumper crop of documentary films, including The Weather Underground.
And how did a terrorist device from Bogota make it to a bank robbery in Erie, Pennsylvania?
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The FBI is launching a worldwide search for four men in connection with possible terror threats against the United States. Two of the men are Saudis, one is Moroccan, the fourth is Tunisian. An official says new information prompted the intensified search. None of the men is believed to be in the U.S. British Airways is considering fitting its aircraft with anti-missile systems. The airline has begun talks with manufacturers Boeing and Airbus about adapting the technology to commercial planes. Just last month, the airline suspended flights to Saudi Arabia after local authorities broke up a terror cell that reportedly was plotting an attack on a British plane. The airline now says it will resume that service this weekend. Some positive but cautious reaction to the U.N. resolution. The U.S. is seeking to get a more multinational presence in Iraq. France and Germany say they are willing to negotiate over the text, and Russia appears to be edging closer to accepting the proposal. It is another day of deadly violence in the Mideast. Israeli troops traded fire with Palestinians today, killing a top Hamas leader and arresting three others before blowing up the apartment building where they found the men. One Israeli soldier was also killed in the gun battle. Two big storms are bearing down on their targets. In the Atlantic, Hurricane Fabian is gaining speed as it heads for Bermuda. It's expected to slam into the island late tonight. People are being warned to board up or leave their properties. Meteorologist Rob Carolyn says it is one of the most powerful storms to hit the island in many years.
The last two storms that they had back in the late 80s and early 90s were more rain producers and produced big surf, but this storm is going to produce the strong winds, and that's usually what does a lot of damage with a hurricane.
Fabian is packing 120-mile-per-hour winds. Building codes require Bermuda structures to withstand winds of 110 miles per hour. Also making waves, Tropical Storm Henri is already sending rain into previously soaked parts of Florida. Some mixed signals today about the health of the U.S. economy. The jobless rate slipped a bit to 6.1%. At the same time, companies were cutting nearly 100,000 jobs from their payrolls. And that's a sign of continuing weakness in the job market. On Wall Street, stocks are mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 36 points at 95.51. NASDAQ is up 10 points at 18.79. And the S&P 500 is up a fraction at 10.28. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The federal government is getting bigger. That's the conclusion of a study released today by the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank. Under President George W. Bush, the federal workforce has grown by more than 1 million people. The increase comes not just in Homeland Security and Defense, but also in Health and Human Services and General Services. Most of the new government workers are employed through contracts and grants and not in the traditional civil service. Some are calling it the biggest expansion of government since the presidency of liberal Lyndon Baines Johnson. So what's a conservative to make of it all? Well, we're joined now by Dan Mitchell, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And welcome, Dan.
Glad to be on the program.
Dan, do you agree with the conclusions of the Brookings report? The federal government is expanding dramatically?
As much as I hate to say this, the Bush administration is guilty as charged in this regard. The federal government is expanding dramatically, whether it's measured as the number of workers, whether it's measured as total government spending as a share of our nation's economic output. The era of big government is back.
Now, where is the growth coming from? The report says it's a largely hidden federal workforce of contractors and grantees as opposed to the civil service. Explain.
Well, when the federal government does something, say they're going to spend $1 billion on Program X. You can hire a bunch of bureaucrats to directly administer Program X, or you can just hire a few bureaucrats who will then give out the money to contractors who will then hire people. So in theory, the contractors and their employees are in the private sector, but in reality, they're just agents of the federal government. But no matter how you slice or dice it, you're still talking about taking resources from the productive sector of the economy, giving it to the government, and the government's going to spend it on things that, in general, don't yield nearly as much benefit to the economy compared to if those resources had just been left in the private sector to create jobs and things like that.
So, clearly enough, you don't think it's a good idea. Why does the conservative presidency of George W. Bush seem to think it's a good idea?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I will defend this administration on many issues. I think their tax policy has, by and large, been a success. I think that it was important to go into Iraq. In many ways, George Bush has done a good job on government spending. They've left the keys to the Treasury door out on the street, and they're letting anybody and everybody and their cousin come in to pilfer the public trough. And government spending has gone up by 2 to 3% of GDP, and about half of that is in defense and homeland security. And you can make an argument that's necessary, that was making up for deficiencies in the past. But you can't make an argument for all the new spending for farm programs, all the new spending for education. These are things that conservatives have correctly argued for years are not legitimate federal responsibilities. These things are bad for the economy. But I'm afraid this administration has made a decision that they don't want to be perceived as mean-spirited and cold and heartless. So therefore, let's squander the people's money on programs that we know doesn't work, but this way maybe Howard Dean can't attack us for being cruel and heartless.
Well, now hold on. There is an argument that people need government for things people need. This was to be the compassionate conservative presidency. Might that not have something to do with his interest in these programs?
Well, I'm sure if I was representing the administration, I would give you that spin. But the point is paying wealthy agribusiness not to grow crops, and as a consequence, by the way, of that, impoverishing people in the third world. That's not compassionate conservatism. That's traditional big government failed programs done at the behest of special interests.
Any recent presidency that did a better job holding the line on this stuff?
Well, I would hate to ever be pinned down on this, but I have to admit Bill Clinton's presidency was much more responsible and frugal when it came to government spending than the current administration. And for that matter, the first President Bush was actually a very big spender. I mean, I'm almost, I mean, not really, but almost wistfully looking back with nostalgia, why can't we bring back Bill Clinton and get some frugality in terms of government spending?
Am I speaking to Dan Mitchell, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation?
Well, again, I'll deny this after the program's over. But on spending, Clinton was much better than Bush.
Will it cost him politically with conservatives?
I think you're seeing in just the last 6 months a lot of angst, a lot of fretting on the part of the president's political base. And what really perhaps is going to be the issue that hurts the administration is this giant Medicare expansion. This is where I think you're beginning to see a lot of conservatives saying, hold on a sec. I mean, you know, this is what we were very upset with Bill Clinton for trying to do back in 1994 with Hillary Care. And just because we have a Republican doing it doesn't make it any better.
Dan Mitchell, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed being on the program.
Dan Mitchell is a senior fellow of the Heritage Foundation. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
All week long, FBI officials have been trying to figure out how Brian Douglas Wells, an unassuming pizza delivery man from Erie, Pennsylvania, secured a neck collar device attached to a bomb that detonated and killed him after a bank robbery. FBI spokesman Bill Crowley said earlier this week that the agency had only seen this type of bomb once before, and that was in Bogota, Colombia. Officials have posted photographs of the neck bomb on their website, hoping that someone might recognize it and call in with a tip. But so far, investigators are mystified. Walter Purdy is director of the Terrorism Research Center in Burke, Virginia. He's on the line with us. And Mr. Purdy, what do you make of this device and its surfacing in Pennsylvania?
Well, it clearly shows that some of these individuals are transferring this type of technology to individuals into the United States.
Does it really show that? I mean, could someone learn how to make this on the Internet, for instance?
Well, this particular device was a little bit more sophisticated, and it's a little bit unusual and outside of the standard things that are posted on the Internet.
Can you describe it for us?
Well, it had a locking mechanism where the individual couldn't take this bomb off. one of the things that we have seen, what is actually called a proxy bomb, where an individual is actually either saddled with a device and sent to go and do something.
It also, as was it, we said, used in Bogota in Colombia. Who would use it? And just give us a brief example of how horrifically they might use it.
Well, individuals with FARC, the terrorist group down there that is waging war against the Colombian government, sending somebody that may have the ability to access a compound, whether it's a military facility, to get inside and then being able to detonate this, usually with the threat that we're going to kill the rest of your family, they're holding them hostage.
I mean, it's just horrifying. And to remind listeners, Brian Wells begged the police to take the collar off. He said someone made him put it on. He didn't name it, and of course it exploded before a bomb squad could get there. How are you in the industry reacting to a device like this surfacing, again, in Erie, Pennsylvania, in a bank robbery?
Well, again, we have seen at times a nexus between criminal elements and some of these terrorist groups, especially in South America, where they really mix together and work so closely. So it doesn't surprise us that we're seeing a criminal element using something that traditional terrorists would be utilizing.
It doesn't surprise you. Do you think this is perhaps the beginning of, you hate to say, a trend or...
Unfortunately, I think it does highlight a trend that we are going to see in the future. A lot of these criminal organizations already have access to structures and pipelines to move people and weapons, and so we could see more of this in the future.
Well, Walter Purdy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Walter Purdy is director of the Terrorism Research Center in Burke, Virginia.
Well, still to come, fiction films strive for reality. Documentaries already have it. We'll take a look at the best of the current crop.
Coming up. Residents of Arizona are used to seeing mirages out in the desert, but in northwest Phoenix, specifically on Sweetwater Avenue between Scottsdale Road and 64th Street, that's where you'll find newly installed painted patterns that give the illusion of speed bumps. The patterns have been used in Europe and a few other U.S. cities in an attempt to slow drivers down, but they've raised a few questions with us, not the least of which is based on the old saying, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Joining us on the line is Mike McCarthy. He's a community organizer who lives along this busy road. And Mike, do you think the painted bumps are fooling anyone?
I think when they first installed them, I think that people were definitely slowing down. But I think once people got used to it, they did absolutely nothing.
Mike, describe these painted bumps to me.
They are about 4 feet wide, and they go across the length of the road. They're dark brown and light brown, and they've got triangles cut into them. The big problem with them is they really kind of blend in too much.
Hmm. Well, the city is saying that in theory it will at least remind people, fool them the first time, and then the second time remind them and they hit the brake.
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're out there more times than not, and it makes no difference.
Well, how bad is it?
It's pretty bad. We're what we call a feeder street, and there's no stop signs, and there's nothing to slow people down. It's a wide open street, so it's faster to go down our street than deal with the traffic on the main streets between us.
Mm. Why not install real speed bumps?
Well, the city has come up with a lot of different reasons for that. Mainly it comes down to money. They're saying that they don't have the money. But they're also saying that it's a feeder street and it's used by fire trucks and policemen, which I've only seen 3 in 5 years. So.
Well, but, if they believe that emergency vehicles will use it, you don't want them hitting a speed bump.
Well, that's true, but I think that there's got to be other alternatives like circles and stop signs, I think, that would work.
Well, in fact, we hear that the city is considering putting circles in. Is that true?
We've been approved for one circle between the mile stretch of road that we have, but we've been shot down on some of the other ideas that we've approached the city with.
Mike, can I just say, speaking to you as a New Englander from here in Boston, I love the circles. Mostly because it's fun to watch tourists get trapped in them, not be able to get out. Are you sure? They're taking them out in some parts of the Boston area. Are you sure you want that?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. It's not a big circle, and I think the way, if they do it correctly like they did in the Scottsdale side, It's actually attractive, and it's not too inconvenient for the drivers.
Well, by the way, the city says in addition to emergency vehicles, these feeder streets also are a conduit for water, and the bumps would pool the water or, you know, maybe direct it in the wrong direction. But in the meantime, the site's going to be monitored for a while, and then the data sent to researchers to let them decide. What do you do in the meantime?
We keep going back to the city and ask them for stop signs and double yellow lines, anything we can do to slow traffic down or, again, to divert it maybe back to the main streets is what we're going to continue to do.
You have the sympathy, I'm sure, of a lot of residents in a lot of cities across the country. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mike McCarthy, community activist who lives on the very busy Sweetwater Avenue in North Phoenix, Arizona.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The summer movie season this year was disappointing for many film critics, except for one particular type of movie, the documentary. So many of them out this summer, it seemed. A trend boosted, maybe even ignited, by the success of last year's Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore's scathing look at gun ownership in America.
Can I help you?
Yeah, I'm here to open up an account.
Okay, what type of account would you?
I want the account where I can get the free gun.
Okay.
I'd spotted an ad in the local Michigan paper that said if you opened an account at North Country Bank, the bank would give you a gun.
You do a CD and we'll hand you a gun. We have a whole brochure here that you can look at.
Mm-hmm.
Once we do the background check and everything,
it's
yours to go.
Okay.
Bowling for Columbine was both a critical and commercial success. It won an Oscar for Best Documentary and grossed over $20 million in the U.S. and Canada. Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer joins us now in the studio to talk about this summer's bumper crop of docs. And welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, was it Bowling for Columbine, Eric, that created this seeming trend toward documentaries?
Well, I think Bowling for Columbine certainly helped to sort of spark an interest in documentaries among filmgoers. And the fact that the thing made, you know, 20 million domestic and about 40 million worldwide, that probably piques the interest of a lot of distributors as well.
That's
who
it.
Might otherwise, you know, sort of ignore documentaries or pass them up for other movies.
Well, Eric, let's run through some of the other documentaries playing this summer. Winged Migration was also an Oscar nominee. It made over $9 million. It's all about birds shot uniquely from sort of small, lightweight, remote-controlled aircraft.
Right. I guess a beautiful film about the glories of flight, you know, not much in terms of, you know, humans in it and so on. But this is another movie that has been extremely popular, as they say in the biz, a movie with legs. It's played for a number of months, and, you know, audiences continue to discover it, and it continues to bring in new people.
A movie with wings, of course, one might be tempted to say, but I won't. And then there's Spellbound, a movie with words, another Oscar nominee about the National Spelling Bee.
Right. And of course, Spellbound is just a completely charming little movie about this National Spelling Bee, but on a much deeper level, a movie about the American dream. And this film, as I think we said when we reviewed it back in June, probably has more suspense than most of the mainstream Hollywood films that have come down the pike.
Well, we do have a clip of Harry, one of the competitors in Spellbound, his torturous attempt to spell the word bands.
You said it's a homonym, and you told me what it means, but am I allowed to ask what its homonym means? All right, I'm starting over. B-A-N-D. What I have so far is B-A-N-D. I don't know if that was a great idea, but... oops, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Oh, well.
Now, Eric, one of the films that got a tremendous amount of attention, one of the documentaries, both pro and con, was the film Capturing the Friedmans, Andrew Jarecki's look at the family of Arnold and Jesse Friedman, who were convicted of child molestation back in the late 80s. Now, you were saying that Spellbound had a lot of suspense. This was also a kind of spellbinding film that it kept moving from one climax to another. You never seemed to know when it was going to end.
And I guess that was sort of one of the controversial things about it, too, was that there was a little bit of questioning after the fact about whether Jarecki might have been able to be a little bit more straightforward about what a lot of people thought was Arnold's innocence of some of these charges. And, you know, he may have sacrificed some of that in order to make a more interesting film. So while documentaries often deal with issues of truth and so on, there are a lot of ethical issues that come up with the making of documentaries, and these can often lead to very interesting and very spirited discussions after seeing some of these movies.
Ethical questions also aroused by a film about the Weather Underground, the radical group from the 60s and 70s. What happens when you make a documentary about a group that had a very controversial and ultimately deadly politics swirling around?
What we wanted to do here was deliver the most horrific hit that the United States government had ever suffered on its territory. We wanted to light it up. Our slogan was bring the war home, and we really wanted to give the United States and the rest of the world a sense that this country was going to be completely unlivable if the United States continued in Vietnam, and that was the goal of this group.
You wind up in this case getting a fascinating look at sort of failed ideals. Here was a group of people who came together, sort of developed out of the Students for Democratic Society movement, and took a much more radical stance. And you get them now, almost 30 years later, looking back on that period, on what was, you know, 10 years out of their lives spent underground, you know, conducting these bombings and so forth. And what's so fascinating about this film, The Weather Underground, is the way it really resonates in so many ways with contemporary society, where we see these sort of radical arms of various political movements, you know, at work in our country, but of course globally then as well.
All of these films, of course, real stories. Now, does it dovetail at all with the phenomenon of reality TV?
I think, if anything, the current wave of documentaries we're seeing are almost a reaction against reality TV. You know, when you turn on reality television, we're so completely aware that what we're seeing is manufactured. These movies are, you know, taking real slices of life, and they're showing us that there is real drama inherent in these situations. You don't have to sort of lard on, you know, fake competitions and so on in order to get some excitement.
And yet these are kind of troubled times. Terrorism, not such a hot economy, and yet people, audiences, not necessarily running for escapist movies.
You know, the big Hollywood narrative blockbusters, they're always going to win out. But I think for a certain segment of the movie-going populace, people who may be a little tired of seeing the same old thing over and over again, the documentaries that are out right now, whether it's Weather Underground or O.T., Our Town, a movie about the production of Our Town in Compton, California, or Step Into Liquid, the movie about surfing, Capturing the Friedmans, all of these movies provide a real alternative. They provide a real excitement to what we're seeing in the usual crop of summer movies.
There is one
well-reviewed, kind of hybrid American Splendor. Not quite a documentary, but kind of close.
Yeah, it's a fascinating film that is about the comic book writer Harvey Pekar, who, you know, kind of appears as a character in his own comics. And so we get these sort of recreated scenes from his life, starring Paul Giamatti as Pekar.
We got a lot of meat on this menu.
You're a vegetarian?
Kinda, you know. I mean, ever since I got a pet cat, you know, I've had a lot of trouble eating animals.
Hmm. I support and identify with groups like PETA, but unfortunately, I'm a self-diagnosed anemic.
Uh-huh.
I guess I have a lot of borderline health disorders that limit me politically when it comes to eating.
Wow, you're a sick woman.
Not yet, but I expect to be. Everyone in my family has some sort of degenerative illness.
And then intersected in there are scenes, interview scenes with the real Pekar. So we get the sort of juxtaposition of the, you know, imagined Harvey and the real Harvey. And it's really quite poignant. And we really see that, you know, the Harvey, as he was portraying himself perhaps in his comics and as he's portrayed in the movie by Giamatti, is somewhat different from the real Harvey. It's a really, really fascinating film.
Documentaries, a trend that's here to stay, at least for a few years?
Well, I'd hoped that we'll continue to see, you know, this kind of number and high quality of documentaries that we've had this summer. It's been a real refreshing change of pace.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, Bill.
Eric Schaefer is a film historian who teaches at Emerson College in Boston.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Emiko Tomogawa, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
Congress holds hearings on intelligence lapses leading up to September 11th, 2001.
And filmmaker Rick Burns' heart-wrenching finale to his New York series, The Rise and Fall of the World Trade Center.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.